Today, Prince Andrew's damaged reputation as one of Jeffrey Epstein's accusers makes further allegations. And Labour MP Paula Sheriff on standing up to Boris Johnson and receiving an ugly response.
The first time in London, I was so young. Gillan woke me up in the morning and said, "You're going to meet a prince today."
This is the voice of Virginia Roberts, one of the many women who has accused disgraced US financier Jeffrey Epstein of abusing her. Last week, along with five other Epstein accusers, she gave her first television interview.
And then that night, Prince Andrew came to her house in London, and we went out to Club Tramp. Prince Andrew got me alcohol. It was in the VIP section. I'm pretty sure it was vodka. Prince Andrew was like, "Let's dance together." And I was like, "Okay." And we leave Club Tramp. And I hop in the car with Gillan and Jeffrey. And Gillan said he's coming back to the house. And I want you to do for him what you do for Epstein.
What Roberts claims she was being asked to do when she was just 17 was have sex with the Duke of York. Over the years, Buckingham Palace have had to issue multiple statements denying any inappropriate behaviour from Prince Andrew. Ghislaine Maxwell has also denied any claims. But how did a member of the royal family become embroiled with a man who is at the centre of a story about international sex trafficking? From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in focus, Prince Andrew's damaged reputation.
Days of eager waiting for Britain and the Commonwealth end with a roar of artillery that signals the birth of a second son to Queen Elizabeth. Countless messages of good wishes and congratulations for the royal family, which now numbers five.
Everyone's fascinated by the royal family, but like trying to get to know what the Queen really thinks is very, very difficult. I mean, she's got four kids, Charles, the oldest, obviously, and then Anne. The youngest is Edward. And third in line was Prince Andrew, who a lot of people say is his mum's favourite. Is that true?
You hear that all the time, you know, the Queen's favourite son.
Chris Shipp is the ITV News royal editor.
Probably, in some respects, the Duke of Edinburgh's favourite son as well, because you had someone in Andrew who was much more in the mould of his father, a bit more of an alpha male, someone who really relished going to Gordonston School up in the north of Scotland, in the way in which Prince Charles didn't. He was much more sensitive. And you still read that line now, you know, the Queen's favourite son.
And I was reading a story recently that suggested the reason he was a favourite was because of the way he kind of skipped university, went straight to Naval College, and then fought in the Falklands.
We are here because for the first time for many years, British sovereign territory has been invaded by a foreign power.
That's my helicopter flying over at the moment. I think it's almost time I should go, but never mind. Somebody's telling me it's time to go.
If we just think back to then, we're talking nearly 40 years ago. He was seen as a war hero in many ways.
Oh, for sure. I mean, coming back from the Falklands, you imagine he sailed back into the south coast of England, part of that tide of euphoria after the Falklands War.
The crowd has been gathering for hours. Streets and approach roads to Portsmouth crammed with cars.
As we know, it's very good for Margaret Thatcher politically at the time. But for the royal family, I think it really was to have someone who actually fought on the front line. There were plenty of debates had at the time in cabinet as well about whether or not he should go to the Falklands. But
he could be a target.
Well, exactly.
There is part of me that says you should all experience what I experienced. But I would never wish it upon any of you.
But interestingly, only 2 years later in 1984... I have recently researched that a book was published entitled Andrew, the Playboy Prince. Did he already have a reputation back then as someone who liked to party?
I think you can say that about anyone who mixes in those sort of circles. You are a very eligible bachelor. You're not married. You're a member of the royal family. I mean, you look at some of the newspaper front pages after the end of the Falklands War, you know, dashing handsome prince in his military uniform.
After that, he begins a relationship with American actress Koo Stark, which attracts huge amounts of press attention. And then when that ends, what is known as Andrew Watch begins, where the press relentlessly document his girlfriends.
From then on, the Andrew Watch kept track of royal girlfriends. There was model Katie Rabbit, Carolyn Herbert, a Die lookalike, Broadway star Finola Hughes, Carolyn Seward, a former beauty queen. The list, constantly updated by a watchful British press, goes on and on.
What's it like for a royal to be in a relationship?
I think it's pretty awful. Koo Stark, I mean, look how much newspaper attention there was surrounding the naval hero Prince Andrew with this very famous woman, Koo Stark, at the time. You only have to sort of get out of a car and walk into a party, and there you get snapped and you're on the front pages. And it's an entirely different way of living your life in the public eye, which is why the royal family always crave that element of privacy where they can get it.
Andrew, Albert, Christian, Edward, wilt thou have this woman to thy wedded wife?
If he was craving privacy, that certainly wasn't something he got after meeting Sarah Ferguson, known as Fergie, who was introduced to Andrew by her friend Princess Diana. They married in 1986.
And out into the sunshine they stepped to face those crowds for the first time as the Duke and Duchess of York, with the enthusiastic and ever hopeful chanting of Kiss the Bride. But that would have to wait. There was first the tricky business of fitting 17 feet of train into a state landau.
Their wedding got so much public attention that the media frenzy around it was known as Fergie fever. What was the public attitude towards him and Fergie at the time that they got married?
She was fascinating. She was absolutely captivating because she was just different, this unpredictable member of the royal family.
Captivating at first, but that did change. The couple had two daughters, Beatrice and Eugenie. But 6 years after they were married, they separated. And that was a very controversial time, wasn't it?
Scandalous stories in the newspapers about their private lives.
And then, of course, she was famously photographed with her financial advisor. I mean, she was wearing a bikini in some garden in the south of France, and he appeared to be sucking her toes. She was at Balmoral when those photographs came out. The family came down to breakfast, and there was Fergie in this shocking scene. And that was the end.
I mean, it was a terrible time for the royal family. I mean, 1996, both the Queen's sons saw their marriages end in divorce. I mean, the 1990s for the royal family was just terrible.
As you say, they divorced. Sarah Ferguson cites her debts as one of the reasons. But also apparently Andrew's naval career, she said she spent months of her marriage alone while he was at sea. He finally leaves the Navy in 2001 to take up a new role.
Prince Andrew has been a roving ambassador promoting British trade since 2001. It's a job that takes him all over the world, helping to secure trade deals.
During this period, Andrew begins to get negative press again and the nickname Air Miles Andy.
Concerns about Andrew's travel costs led to a report by Parliament's National Audit Office. It cleared him of wrongdoing, but did reveal the huge amounts spent ferrying him around.
He was flying to Azerbaijan, to Kazakhstan, to Libya, to the Middle East. Now, don't forget, our royal family has a lot of influence with the, you know, with the Emiratis and a lot of those countries in the Middle East where they are held in great respect.
Well, it's a fact of life. In order to do what I do for the UK and for UK business, I have to travel. Well, that's it. It's one of those unfortunate, as it were, tags that one has to put up with.
I mean, he argued that he had to travel for his job, but to be clear, he was called Air Miles Andy because his expenses were higher than the other royals. And I think that built up this idea of a sense of entitlement. And then you had his friendship choices. He was friends with Colonel Gaddafi's son and Tariq Khatouni, a Libyan gun smuggler who he invited to his daughter Eugenie's wedding last year. Even then, people were criticising his judgment. Do you think that was fair?
I think with hindsight, if you look back, you do build up a picture of someone who liked to have friends and acquaintances who were both very powerful and also very rich. Now, some of that was related to the role that he took on after he left the Royal Navy and became a sort of trade envoy for the UK, which he did for the best part of a decade. And therefore, you might say, well, he would have these sort of contacts, wouldn't he? But there were many, many people that were questioning the kind of leaders in Azerbaijan, Kazakhstan, or at the time in Libya, when Colonel Gaddafi was still there, and they will question his judgment and the friends that he decided to keep.
The most problematic, of course, has been his friendship with convicted paedophile Jeffrey Epstein. How did they first meet?
So Prince Andrew and Jeffrey Epstein met through Ghislaine Maxwell, the daughter of the tycoon Robert Maxwell. That was in 1999. It's that relationship that began then and that he kept up subsequently that's become such a big issue for him now.
And the details of their friendship are quite eye-opening. I mean, they moved in very elite circles. In 2000, Prince Andrew and Ghislaine Maxwell were seen on holiday with Epstein at Mar-a-Lago, which is Donald Trump's Florida estate. The president has subsequently played down the idea of a friendship with Epstein and distanced himself from him.
I knew him like everybody in Palm Beach knew him. I had a falling out with him a long time ago. I don't think I've spoken to him for 15 years. I wasn't a fan.
Epstein and Maxwell attended a party at Windsor Castle, which was marking the birthdays of various royals, including the Queen Mother and Andrew. Were there questions at the time over this friendship?
I think Jeffrey Epstein was a much bigger story in the US than it was here, and it was only from about 2010, after Epstein's conviction for soliciting sex from a minor, that it really became a problem for Prince Andrew. But again, we're coming back to a group of friends that if you were to ask people in the street what they thought of Prince Andrew keeping that sort of company, then they would raise question marks.
Isn't it more than just bad judgment, but also not acting when revelations came to light? I mean, in 2010, Jeffrey Epstein had been jailed for essentially being a paedophile. And Prince Andrew took a decision to visit him in Manhattan. He then got photographed in Central Park with him, which led to a News of the World front page saying Prince Andy and the pedo. How was he able to continue with that friendship after the guy had been jailed?
Good question. I mean, nobody knows why he went to see him in 2010 after Epstein had been convicted. He calls that an error of judgment. Whatever way you look at it, that was a mistake. He shouldn't have done it. And I don't think you'll find anyone who disagrees with that.
And do we understand why he behaved like that? I mean, some might think that it's to do with loyalty to a friendship, but there was also this idea that there was a certain arrogance. I mean, there was a WikiLeaks cable in which the US ambassador described him as behaving cockily. Do we think he just thought that none of this could touch him?
I think it was a huge oversight on his part. If he didn't think that this could touch him, then that clearly says something about his judgment. Anything to do with somebody who's been convicted of sexual offences involving someone who was underage, you would wipe them off your contacts book. You would stop seeing them. You would decide never to go to New York and see him again. Yet Prince Andrew decided that he would.
It went from bad to worse for Andrew, didn't it? I mean, when Fergie's debt came back into the picture, it turned out Jeffrey Epstein had given her money to help pay off her debts. How damaging was that?
Well, it became a family problem again, didn't it? I mean, here you've got the husband going and seeing Jeffrey Epstein in 2010, and then it transpires that his former wife had taken £15,000 from Jeffrey Epstein to help clear her debts, and she had to be absolutely apologetic about that as well. She had to say things like how much she abhors paedophilia. It involved both of them now, tied up in a controversy surrounding a man who carried out some absolutely abhorrent things.
Criticism over his questionable choice of friendship seems to have been a driving factor in Prince Andrew stepping down from his role as UK trade envoy. By 2011, A picture from the past emerged of him with his arm around Virginia Roberts when she was 17. She claimed that she'd been made to work as a sex slave for Epstein and that she had encountered Prince Andrew during that period. Now, newspapers at the time ran the story, but with disclaimers that there was no suggestion of sexual contact between her and him. But that changed dramatically in 2015, didn't it?
So she named him in court papers in a civil case against Ghislaine Maxwell. And she said in those court papers, or she made allegations that she'd had sex with Prince Andrew, and they were emphatically denied by the palace.
Gouffray says she was directed to have sex with several powerful men, like former New Mexico Governor Bill Richardson, former Maine Senator George Mitchell, and Prince Andrew. All of the men have denied those allegations.
In the United States, you have absolute privilege in court, but we should be clear that the judge took those claims and struck them out of court. The judge said in 2015 they were immaterial and impertinent.
Struck out because they were irrelevant to the case.
Irrelevant to the particular defamation case that was going on at the time in 2015, yes.
But despite the situation being taken out of court, this was a crisis for the palace, wasn't it? I mean, they took the unprecedented step of issuing a statement in which they said any suggestion of impropriety with underage minors is categorically untrue. How badly did that hit Prince Andrew's reputation?
I mean, I think any association with somebody who'd already been convicted of sex offences with underage girls was going to be bad. There's no way of getting out of that. I mean, you've got this thing in the palace where they say sort of never complain, never explain, and you just get your head down, you get on with it. Every so often, that strategy meets reality and it can't work, and they have to therefore decide, do I issue a personal statement? And that's what they did in this case in 2015.
I've just wished to reiterate and to reaffirm the statements which have already been made on my behalf by Buckingham Palace.
Right, fast forward 4 years. This story has in many ways gone away for Prince Andrew, but investigative journalists in the US have doggedly pursued the allegations against Epstein. Finally, he's facing very, very serious federal charges. Dozens of potential victims have been identified. There's a suggestion he'll never get out of jail and that the net could close in on his extremely high-profile associates.
Today, we announce the unsealing of sex trafficking charges against Jeffrey Epstein.
He sexually assaulted dozens of young girls.
Some as young as 14.
These young girls thought, essentially, that they were going to be going there to get paid to give him a massage. And instead, what he did was he pressed them further and further each time to have sexual and intimate relations with him.
And then, while awaiting trial last month, Epstein kills himself.
From the moment after his death, it meant that all of these allegations that might have had to wait for a court case or be tested in court, or perhaps lawyers will have decided that they don't meet the threshold to go to court, all of those sort of claims suddenly found their way into both the American and the British press.
Virginia Roberts Jeffrey, pictured here with Prince Andrew, claims Epstein forced her to have sex with the royal on three separate occasions when she was 17.
Before you know it, I'm being lent out to politicians and to academics and to people that you, royalty.
Epstein's story kept delivering new twists and turns, new allegations, and we got to the point where the palace were having to think about whether or not to issue a statement again.
Yeah, his death seemed to trigger new details about that 2010 stay. Literary agent John Brockman, for example, sent an email to a client with details of Brockman's stay at Epstein's mansion. In the email, which was revealed last month, Brockman recalls Prince Andrew complaining about how Prince Albert of Monaco could do whatever he wanted after 9 p.m, whereas Andrew felt this was a luxury he was denied. This conversation was taking place while he and Epstein were getting foot massages from two young Russian women. And there was that video of him
showing Prince Andrew at deceased billionaire Jeffrey Epstein's Manhattan mansion. In the video, purportedly taken in 2010, the prince is allegedly seen waving goodbye to a young woman from the front door. He even appears to check to make sure no one is looking.
That video was a serious, serious problem for the palace. It was part of that whole story in 2010 and when he'd stayed with Epstein. Suddenly, boom, this story was massive news again right in the middle of August. And then on a Saturday, happened to be the bank holiday weekend, the palace got in touch with us and to say that there will be a personal statement from the Duke of York. He wanted to put his sympathies with the victims. He wanted to say that he had no knowledge of or involvement in the crimes that Epstein was subsequently accused of. And he spoke about, you know, he saw him once a year and he's known him for 10 years and reiterated the fact that he has not seen him since that mistaken visit in 2010.
But he also said in that statement, "I can only reiterate my regret that I was mistaken to think that what I thought I knew of him was evidently not the real person, given what we now know." But he did know that he'd been jailed for soliciting minors for prostitution.
That's the problem. The difficulty with this entire story is that the Duke of York says emphatically he did not know the allegations of Jeffrey Epstein's behaviour beyond, of course, the conviction in 2008. The very fact they have to issue a statement of that nature shows how serious this was becoming.
But for the royal family, it's so difficult to deal with this because those claims have been aired. They've been talked about. That picture has reemerged of him with his arm around Virginia Roberts. There have been some weird claims that that picture's doctored.
It's a very odd line of defence, isn't it? It actually prompted me to go back and look at them because there's some talk about Prince Andrew's fingers are too fat or they're not his fingers because they're fatter than those ones, or the angle at which he's standing, you couldn't actually get your arm around the photo. Maybe it's true, maybe it's not. I don't think any of us can tell. But the photo, the original of that photo, doesn't exist. The one that we're all very familiar with is a photo of a photo. The palace do say that the Duke never remembers meeting Virginia Roberts. Now, he meets a lot of people. He's bound to meet people that we simply don't know about.
And it doesn't feel as if the negative press is going to go away. A few weeks ago, there was a story claiming that Prince Andrew had an altercation with a palace aide and that Prince Charles had had to intervene.
Prince Andrew was reported not to have got on well with this particular aide and they had a row and his brother, Prince Charles, had to step in. I mean, there are rumours that that story was planted by Clarence House, by the Prince of Wales's office.
No.
Well, you know, apparently Prince Charles and Prince Andrew don't massively see eye to eye.
Which is interesting because that was an incredibly damaging story for Prince Andrew in the middle of all the issues that he's dealing with because of his association with Epstein. We've just talked at length about the things that Prince Andrew has been through over these years. I mean, reputationally, what are the palace trying to do to change the emphasis for him?
Well, look, I think what the Duke of York's trying to do at the moment is just get on with the day job. So very recently, he was in Bruges talking about the liberation of that city after the end of the Second World War. He's the colonel of the Grenadier Guards. He was getting on with that job. One thing I will say about the Duke of York is that something that he does is an event called Pitch a Palace. Now, if you think of Dragon's Den on TV, where you go and you pitch your ideas to a group of people who have got money. Pitch a Palace event is apparently, according to the palace, raised £1 billion worth of investment, created sort of 3,000 or 4,000 jobs. He's put a lot of focus into it in the last few years. Then he was in Northern Ireland. He runs a trophy for young golfers. But even there, he was seen talking to a reputation management consultant in Northern Ireland, which in itself became a bit of a story. Why would he be talking to a guy?
Why would he be?
Well, exactly.
You could tell me, Chris.
Well, he's a family friend, we're told. He's worked for Sarah, the Duchess of York, before, and he's based in Northern Ireland. So they were chatting in the golf course. Do we know what they were chatting about? No, we don't. I think the more often he turns up, the more bored the cameras will get and the less often they'll turn up. He'll just simply try and get back to some form of normality. The big question is, does his reputation recover from this? I think it would take quite some time. And it would also involve the allegations surrounding his involvement with Jeffrey Epstein to go away. And that will require there to be no new developments in the United States at all. And it's hard to see how that story in the US is going to go away. Because if people feel like they've been wronged, as these victims say they have been, then they're going to want to take some further legal action.
Chris, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Chris Shipp, ITV News Royal Editor. Coming up, why MPs are dismayed by the language used by the Prime Minister.
The way things are isn't the way they have to be.
But knowing what to challenge and how to change it isn't always clear.
That's why independent journalism has never mattered more.
When we are free to follow any lead
and question any authority,
we can confront the status quo,
uncover vital alternatives,
and bring clarity to the world's most complex issues.
We can help our readers understand the world.
So together, we can fight for a better one. Hope is power.
And with your support,
you'll always find it
at The Guardian.
Now, scores of MPs in Parliament have been demanding an apology from Boris Johnson after he infuriated them by claiming that the best way to honour the memory of murdered politician Joe Cox was to deliver Brexit. It all began after Labour's Paula Sheriff asked the Prime Minister to stop using inflammatory language like Surrender Act, warning that she and other colleagues were facing death threats.
With many of us in this place subject to death threats and abuse every single day. And let me tell the Prime Minister that they often quote his words, Surrender Act, betrayal, traitor. He should be absolutely ashamed of himself.
I have to tell you, Mr. Speaker, I have to say, Mr. Speaker, I've never heard such humbug in all my life.
I was absolutely stunned and mortified by his response. I hadn't ever thought in my worst nightmares that he would respond in that manner. I genuinely hadn't. You know, the fact that the Prime Minister was so, at best, ambivalent, but flippantly dismissive of a female MP talking about threats and abuse. I mean, had that been in another country, I just wonder how we would have reflected on that over here. Is his pursuit of power so great that he is prepared to risk the safety, particularly of female MPs? I know my colleague Jess Phillips has spoken to him and said, you know, I got a death threat last night, Mr. Johnson, and you were quoted. Of course, I worry what would happen in the event of a general election or a second referendum in terms of MPs' safety. And it's also about our staff. My staff are having to read all these emails today saying I'm this, I'm that, I'm the other. And it's not fair on them. People are ringing my office today and shouting abuse. You know, I'm sure the Prime Minister would try and up the ante in terms of the rhetoric. And we've seen that words have consequences.
Tracy Brabin.
As the woman who has taken over a seat that was left by our dear friend Joe Cox, can I ask him, in all honesty, for, as a human being, please, please, will he, going forward, moderate his language so that we will all feel secure when we're going about our jobs?
Is it the best way to honour the memory of Joe Cox, and indeed the best way to bring this country together, would be, I think, to get Brexit done. And I absolutely do.
For him to actually say the best way to honour Joe was to get Brexit done was breathtaking. And to say that to Tracy Brabin, who obviously was the MP who took over from Joe in Batley and Spurn, was incredibly insensitive at best. I do believe that our Prime Minister is inciting hatred. We have to be clear that Joe's death didn't happen in a vacuum. Joe's death happened amidst a toxic, divisive atmosphere, which was obviously around the Brexit debate. There is a genuine fear amongst MPs of all parties that there could well be another attack, or we're leading up to one, because we're not stupid, we can feel the tension rising.
That was Paula Sheriff, the Labour MP for Dewsbury. My thanks to her and to Chris Shipp. This episode was produced by Chika Ayres and Gary Marshall. Sound design was by Axel Cocoutier. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. Have a great weekend, and we'll be back on Monday.